This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you, Lena, for inviting me to speak as part of the GRIT series. Thanks to all of you for coming, spending the early evening with me, even if some of you were required to be here. But it's really exciting to give a talk to the next generation of hotshot researchers. Okay, I want to open with a question. It's going to be a little bit awkward, but bear with me. Overall, how satisfied are you with your life nowadays? So think from a scale from 0 to 10, 0 not at all satisfied, 10 completely satisfied. So answer that in your head, store the answer. Maybe you prefer a different phrasing. How about if you were to consider your life in general, how happy or unhappy would you say you are on the whole? Again, ranging from fairly unhappy to completely happy. I'm not going to put any of you on the spot and ask you what your answers are, but if I were to take all of your responses and just analyze them and see what exactly might that look like if we think about happiness or well-being as a function of age, what might that look like across the life course? And this is basically largely how social scientists measure happiness and well-being, with simple questions like this. We'll return by the end whether this is the best way to do it, but there's lots and lots and lots of data that look exactly like this. And so if we took all that data, put it together, it's probably going to look something like this, which is called the U-shape, although this looks a little bit V-shaped, but a U or V-shaped curve of well-being, life satisfaction, or happiness. So if you start early, around your age, most of you now, you're at the peak right here. Things are good. You're relatively happy, I hope. But on average, looking a little bit forward, things tend to slide a little bit till the point where you reach my age and you're in the peak of despair, right? This is the midlife crisis, midlife slump. Although I drive a Honda Clarity, so that's hardly the midlife crisis car. But looking forward, on the other end, maybe things are going to get better, things are going to look up, and so well-being increases. So this U-shape curve has been analyzed across many different samples in many different countries in many academic papers, and so much so that it's been considered almost like a human universal and is entered. It's not just something that's in the academic literature, but something that pervades the public imagination. So I don't know how many of you have read this, but maybe your relatives, older relatives, have the happiness curve, why life gets better after age 50. So just to show you a little bit what these data actually look like, here's an example. So the phrasing for the kind of question is similar, but maybe a little bit different than the ones I showed you. But here's data from 36 European countries, large data sets, and you can see something that looks largely kind of U or V-shaped here. Again, high well-being early in life, it drops a little bit, and then increases later in life. And if you're wondering, how big is this drop, you know, on these? What does the y-axis mean? One way to think about it is the equivalent of, say, a divorce or losing a job. That's about the size, the effect size of this gap right here. And now when we think about what's going on with age, so here maybe, you know, you're in your prime, you don't have a whole lot of responsibility, but now you start gaining responsibility and all of a sudden you're responsible for other people. You get to this point, maybe there's a burden of work and kids and family and all that. And so you can imagine all the different things that occur as a function of age. Maybe that's what's responsible here. But the fact that we all vary in our experiences like that, not just within populations, across populations, and things occur at different ages, we can adjust for that, those factors. And when you adjust for that, that's this curve that says with controls. What you find is, if anything, the U-shape still exists, and sometimes it even comes out stronger. So there's this age effect, irrespective of what's going on with age. So similarly, here's the UK, some data, even a bigger data set, and again, you see this U-shaped curve. Now notice here is a little bit of difference. By the time the 70s, you see well-being either kind of leveling off or maybe even sometimes declining, and that's observed in some places, but you still see this U-shape over most of the life course. All right, Now, this idea that it's a human universal, some have even proposed that it's not just limited to all humans, but something we might even observe, you know, across larger scales. We're a primate, right? So let's look at the primates. And there's one study that actually looked at chimpanzees and orangutans, so some of our closest primate cousins. And if you're wondering, how do you train chimpanzees and orangs to answer these kinds of questions? Well, they don't. It's the people who are caring for these apes in sanctuaries and zoos that are answering the same kinds of questions that humans normally answer. And lo and behold, you analyze the data and you get something that also looks relatively U-shaped. Now, I will preface this with, this is the only study that I'm aware of on non-human primates, and it's never been replicated, so maybe some of you might attempt to try to replicate this in the future. And if you're wondering, okay, this U-shaped thing, it's kind of interesting, but looks just something not intuitive. So from my point, remember, I'm in the midlife crisis phase of my life. Looking forward, my health isn't getting any better, right? I expect some hardship in the future. Friends come, friends go, they might move away. Loved ones come, and maybe they move away. You start losing loved ones and friends through death. And so there's a lot of hardship expected. And so the fact that, if anything, your life is going to get harder and that your health might deteriorate, the fact that, if anything, well-being is increasing over that phase seems a little bit paradoxical. So, all right, let's step back for a little bit and say, well, is this U-shape really universal? And if so, why? Now, most of the studies of well-being are people like you or me. In other words, weird people. And by weird, I mean people living in countries that identified as Western, educated, industrialized, rich democracies. Now, of course, our lives count, but on a global stage, we represent a relatively small proportion of the population, but the vast proportion of all studies within psychology and other social sciences. Now, I'm an anthropologist, so I'm used to actually stepping outside the usual convenience samples of university classrooms and exploring diversity in all of its manifestations, but also not just the fact that many people around the world don't live in the global north, but the fact that our experiences right now in urban living is a minor blip in the large-scale evolutionary history of our species. So to say that the U-shaped happiness curve is everywhere, we just don't know that that's the case yet. All right, so enter where I've been working for over two decades now is in Bolivia, with several groups of indigenous populations who make a life through hunting, through fishing, through gathering, through making fields of various crops. So this is in the Bolivian Amazon, inhabiting over 90 villages. There's roughly about 17,000 Chimane right now. And actually, I'm a co-director of a project, the Chimane Health and Life History Project, where it's actually a longitudinal study of physical aging and health. Now, for the longest time, I focused on physical health, and now, you know, moving into the realm of thinking about mental health. And just to give you a sense, you know, what is it that, you know, Chimane and Mosetén, what do they eat? Well, since they're hunters and fishers, they're eating the local game and wildlife. So, like, here's a coatimundi, here's a paca, you've got some fruits, you've got varieties of fish. From people's fields, you've got plantains, papaya, sweet manioc, some rice, and corn. But separate from just what people eat and how they move their bodies, just think about, people are living in relatively small-scale populations, clusters of related families, in a face-to-face kind of society where you pretty much know everyone around you, and your family lives relatively close by. So very distinct way of living. And, you know, so having the luxury or the privilege of being able to work amongst the Chimane and Mosetén for such a long time, I've just got to really know really wonderful people, including this woman who, you know, early back in her 60s, she was already the matriarch of her village. She had seven adult children who were alive in the village and 31 grandchildren. Very friendly, very happy-go-lucky. Everyone liked her. The next time I saw her, she had already lost her husband, but her eldest son and her daughter-in-law were kind of living with her and taking care of her. And so it was a bit of a down period. And then when I just saw her last year, she was still spry, limited mobility, but you can see she actually looks pretty darn good, like compared almost like she was 20 years prior. And so overall, you know, well-adjusted and enjoying life. And here's another person who, when they were about 39 years old, they were the chief of their village, very quiet, but good sense of humor, well-spoken, people liked him. His wife got uterine cancer, and she passed away, and this was following after one of his children had passed away, so a really horrible kind of set of circumstances. And then by the time I saw him last year, he had remarried, started a new family, and so he was doing well, but you can see like the toll of those years, you know, just even just looking visually, you know, that, you know, he aged. So taking these sort of anecdotal impressions and then trying to move and complement that with more systematic kinds of surveys, I wanted to look at life satisfaction and well-being, but do it more than just one question, at least maybe try 16 of the kinds of items that are often present on many kind of inventories of depression or low mood. And the first thing we found is that basically depression, if it's increasing over the life course. So it's in both men and women. And this part, from, you know, your age until about my age, is consistent with the U-shape, right? That depression is increasing, so well-being is declining. But this latter part is sort of inconsistent. Rather than seeing an upswing in well-being, we're actually seeing an increase in depression score, so inconsistent with the U-shape. Now, fast forward 10 years later, you know, I actually did ask these kind of single kinds of questions. So here's one example. Do you feel joy or happiness now in your life? So do people say often versus sometimes or never? And as you can see for both the Chimane and the Mosaten, and now here's a slightly different age range. It's from sort of that midlife onward. You see not an uptick of happy life, but the probability of saying you often feel happy is declining with age for both men and women in both populations. Now, evolution doesn't really care about whether or not we're happy. And even the ancient Greeks didn't think that the pursuit of happiness was the point of life. They focused on living a fulfilling life, a life with purpose and meaning, what they referred to as eudaimonia. It's a tongue twister of a word. And so we asked a similar question. Do you now feel that your life has meaning and purpose? And do people say often compared to sometimes or never? And similarly, we see on this separate measure of well-being, a decline after midlife. Now, sorry, the error bars aren't coming through here, but with the Chimane, there's a little bit something different going on here, but there's really high uncertainty. So for the most part, the fact that through midlife, you're seeing a decline in this level of well-being as well, inconsistent with the U-shape. So I talked about the U-shape initially, and now here I'm showing you a very different kind of population and results inconsistent with the U-shape. How do we reconcile this contradiction? So first of all, this paradox of old age upswing in life satisfaction, what's the usual reason given for it? Well, some of it is that with age, you supposedly get wiser. You learn to accept the things, right, you can't change. You start to appreciate the things you have, maybe instead of striving for the things you don't have. And maybe just with age, it sort of blunts that sharp edge of ambition, of striving. And so once we're no longer kind of competing, maybe we can relax a little bit and appreciate the smaller things in life. Maybe that's true, but I want to give a proposal here for what I think might be going on. So all of us that tend to live, you know, mostly in the global north, that experiencing, you know, conditions very different from how we live the majority of our existence as a species, that maybe this increased well-being with age is more likely under certain conditions of today, where you have formal retirement as opposed to no retirement, which is the situation with groups like the Chimane and Mosaten, where you have some security. So even if you're no longer working or not working as much, that the fact that you have a way of securing income, versus being wholly dependent and reliant on other people in the absence of formal institutions. An economy where you're not necessarily using your physical body to extract resources from the environment, but you have a job where you're maybe in the service or information economy, even in a factory, but you're not necessarily, you can do that with somewhat debilitating health. Having adequate health care, as opposed to having minimal or no effective health care. And of course, being embedded in a social community, as opposed to maybe living by yourself with a small family or no family in relative isolation. So under these conditions, we might expect an increase in well-being with age after that midlife point versus in this situation. So the idea of putting all this together, it's feeling useful and needed, when that sort of outweighs the challenges, physical and otherwise, that you might experience in older lives, that's when you might expect this increase in well-being. So some data, well, actually before getting to data, let me just illustrate this conceptually, right? If we think about production in the broadest kind of way, it's making money, but it's also hunting and gathering. It's even sharing ideas and educating others and mediating conflict, all the different ways that we could be useful to other people within our community. Most production curves tend to look something like this in human populations, where it's increasing pretty big in midlife, and then declines to a point where eventually it crosses zero. And so let's just say here's the point where you might be a grandparent and there's still adequate, you know, decent amount of productivity. And all this period of positive production, you know, you're an asset to yourself, to your family, to your friends, to your community. But there's a point at which you're not really producing anything, but you're still eating, you're still breathing, you're still just maintaining your life. And so you might think of yourself in some ways as a burden in the kind of harsh, cold calculus of life. And so, and then in between, this sort of transition from asset to burden. And you can imagine that this transition from asset to burden is going to vary from population to population, even within a population, from person to person, depending on various things like your physical health, your condition, the networks you find yourself embedded within, do you have caregivers around you, and your overall productivity and value to others. And putting all that together, this should be shaping, in many ways, our well-being. Now, this pattern, this transitioning from asset to burden, in a lot of traditional societies, there's this pattern of what's called death-hastening behaviors. And again, going back to this kind of harsh, cold calculus, death-hastening behaviors can be something as more trivial, like neglect, to sort of more severe forms of treatment, like abandonment, or in some cases, gerontocide, which is the killing of elders. So some of you probably heard, you know, anecdotes about, you know, amongst Inuit up north, sending grandpa out on the ice floe. So sorry, these are serious matters, but to make a little bit light, with climate change, maybe there won't be enough ice to send grandparents off on the ice floe. But I want to illustrate this idea because it's not so far-fetched from current issues we face today with global aging, where we want to care for our elders, but at the same time, there's constraints and other commitments we have. And so here's a quote, you know, from from an adult amongst the Netsilik, who are a group of Canadian Inuit. And it's a little bit long, but I think it's telling. "And if he has to be at the breathing holes next morning for hunting at the proper time to secure food, he cannot travel backwards and forwards between the old and the new camp to salvage an old woman. He has the choice between helping one who is at death's door anyhow and allowing his wife and children to starve. This is how it is, and we see no wickedness in it. Perhaps it is more remarkable that old Kigtak, an elder, now that she is no longer able to fend for herself, still hangs on as a burden to her children and grandchildren. For our custom up here is that all old people who can do no more and whom death will not take, help death to take them. And they do this not merely to be rid of a life that is no longer a pleasure, but also to relieve their nearest relations of the trouble they give them. So you see this kind of tension between, you know, being alive, but not wanting to be a burden to your family and others in the midst of this sort of transition from asset to burden. So, all right, what does all this have to do with then? It's bad enough that things aren't going great for you. Why do you need to feel bad on top of that? So why lower mood in later life? And here's, just step back a little bit, you know, emotions are not just these willy-nilly sparks that distract us from trying to do what we want to do. In fact, going all the way back to Darwin, you know, emotions, these are adaptations that part of our psychological machinery that evolved to, in some ways, think about their motivators, right? Trying to solve different adaptive problems. So here's just an example of some proposed functions of low mood that might help serve adults in this transition from asset to burden, but in this period of from midlife to later life, where having low mood might communicate to others in your community that you need help. It could be signaling yielding in a competitive conflict situation, so analogous to submission-like behavior in non-human animals. It could also, slowing down and pausing might serve functions to ruminate, to solve problems, to cope with various challenges, and in many ways to disengage and try something else if your current strategy isn't working. And then lastly, to conserve energy in light of food insecurity, in light of infection. There's some good evidence that depression, some of it, looks like sickness behavior in non-human animals. So various kind of functions where low mood might help during this period, might help explain why in hunter-gatherers and populations like that, where you don't see well-being increasing, but well-being decreasing or remaining unchanged over the latter part of life. All right, so just a few kind of results that are consistent with these ideas. So I showed you before that amongst the Chimane, that depression was increasing with age and adulthood. But as part of our biomedical team, we actually have clinical diagnoses from physicians for everyone, every time they're seen by our clinic. And what you can see is that it's like a dose response. For every additional clinical diagnosis people had, they were more depressed, both women and men. And in many ways, the effect of your health is as strong, if not even stronger, than the effect we see with age. And we also found that depression was associated with higher physical disability, lower economic productivity. So again, thinking about how these are so important for being useful to others, greater food insecurity, and conflict with kin over these types of tensions over, you know, these things that we just talked about. And in many ways, when you adjust for these things, it actually eliminates the effect of age that we see with well-being. All right, so zooming out from just my work with the Chimane, I teamed up with others who also are interested in well-being outside the weird context, but especially in rural living, because rural living, in this case, these are forest living folks in a variety of countries. I'm not going to go through each one of these little curves. This is well-being on the y-axis, age on the x-axis. I just want to show you that all these ones with red boxes are in patterns inconsistent with the U-shape. It's either well-being is relatively flat, or it's declining, or it's an inverted U rather than a U-shape. In other words, no midlife crisis here. And if you take the countries from the same continent and group them, we can say at least within Africa and Asia, we don't see patterns consistent with the U-shape, that on average, you tend to see average well-being either declining here or an inverted U versus the U-shape. All right, now some of you might be thinking, oh, I thought low mood and depression, that was only, you know, something we see in rich countries and, you know, in the past or in small-scale societies. You know, isn't everyone just kind of getting along okay? Well, no, and in fact, the more that this is actually looked at systematically outside weird populations, you see it almost everywhere. So this is just showing you in countries like from Costa Rica, South Africa, Brazil, India, that there's a, decent, non-trivial amount of people reporting depression. I'm not saying major clinical depression, but at least just low mood, low affect in a bunch of different countries. And sometimes it's often increasing with age too, just like we saw with the Chimane and Mosetem. But even taking that into account, in weird countries where you do see U-shapes, European countries, there's exceptions that actually, these tweaks that actually are consistent with these ideas I'm trying to convey, that in European countries with lower per capita GDP, so poorer countries, they're more likely to show fluctuating or age-related declines in subjective well-being. And also, in European countries, when livelihoods are difficult to maintain in those later years, especially where welfare programs are minimal, steeper age-related declines in well-being have been reported. All right, now you want the bad news or the good news? I'll start with the bad news. The bad news is that even amongst the U-shape proponents, that in the last few years, things have shifted. So the U-shape doesn't seem to exist in the same way anymore, and it's mostly affecting all of you that in the youngest years actually has the lowest reported well-being now across the life course. So that's the bad news. The good news is that, well, at least if you're here at rock bottom, there's only upwards to go. So the future years are looking better. But the other piece of good news too is this is on a 4-point scale, right? And if you look here closely at the axis, this is all above 3. So it's varying degrees of satisfied on average, right? This is not misery, but on average, varying degrees. But again, this is important. And this is not just observed now in the US, but has now been reported and observed just in a paper last week that was reported in maybe upwards of 50 or more countries. So something different going on now. All right, let's put it all together. Well, I threw a lot of stuff at you. What have we learned? Well, first of all, be careful when making generalizations about human behavior, and especially about claims of universality, right? If our samples are mostly, the convenience samples of the university classroom, and even when we focus on countries in the global south, if it's an internet-based study, or if it's looking at university students, again, this is not giving us a big picture of the human condition. Also, don't despair. Midlife crises are not universal, so that's a good piece of news. And that also, just recognize that mostly what I've been talking about today is averages. And averages obscure the variability. Individual life trajectories matter. So this is not destiny by any means. And that happiness, whether it's rising or falling, it depends on this balance between the challenges we face and all of the accommodations. So maybe in rural, more subsistence-type contexts, those challenges outweigh the accommodations we have, whereas in high-income countries, to a large extent, maybe those accommodations outweigh those challenges. And also, methodology matters. I didn't talk much about methodology, but mostly social scientists obsess about different statistical methods and sampling. All that stuff's important, but it's not enough, right? We need to focus on the role of culture, the role of ecology, the structural factors that shape our understanding, but shape our happiness over the life course. And lastly, it's not enough anymore to just focus on life expectancy at birth, right? To think about how well are we doing. It's the quality of our years that matter, not just the quantity of our years. And whether you think these questions about trying to measure well-being are good or not, we're going to see a lot more attention on how can we best measure and capture well-being along with just years of life lived. So life satisfaction, we're going to see much more of this kind of work in the future. All right, thank you so much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.